Welcome to Crunching Tackles, where we break down the hardest hitting social issues in sports. On today's show, recent events in Wake Forest have incited another round of debate about court storming and fan behavior during college sports games. I'm Chad Wiley, and with me as always, while he skipped the pre-taped Super Bowl interview, he's here with us tonight. It's John Nekrasov.
I'm here, unlike a certain somebody who definitely did do that. Now, do you want to explain that joke to the audience? Because I feel like, and as niche political jokes go, which really is sort of like the bread and butter of this podcast, I don't, has there ever been a more niche one on this podcast?
I don't think so.
I'm not sure.
I think two things. One, it's too bad that we weren't on top of this before we did our Super Bowl recap pod, because this is obviously part of the Super Bowl. Basically, the president does an interview, like a very, very softball kind of interview with people that do the NFL games, like the Super Bowl pregame coverage, like an hour before kickoff. And Joe Biden's skipped it for some reason, even though it's a way to get a lot of views. It's a way to get your voice in front of a lot of people. And usually, like, again, it's not really Jake Tapper coming after you on CNN State of the Union or something. It's usually a pretty friendly exchange.
Much less Tucker Carlson.
Right. Much less. But he skipped it. So,
Interesting.
I'm glad that we're talking about the Super Bowl at all, though, because I did just want to, like, bookend our conversation from last time, which is just to say the Super Bowl did break the record.
It did.
Which is quite, I think we expected it, but, like, to actually happen is again, like, quite incredible. And I did want to make sure that we mentioned that after talking about whether or not it would.
It is
was the most watched Super Bowl of all time.
Yeah, it's remarkable. And that's the second most televised event in American history behind the moon landing, which is kind of just surprising.
That's really crazy.
More than anything. Like, I find it interesting because, you know, we talked often about in the early days of this podcast, which was like 2020, we talked often about things like CTE and a lot of the health concerns around the sport of football. We talked about youth participation in football. That was something that really interested both of us and interested me as someone who, you know, in the grand scheme of things is relatively new to the NFL. What's been remarkable to me over these last 4 or 5 years has been that not only have all the boycotts that, you know, were so prevalent in the 2010s and was such a huge political hot button topic, not only have those basically completely faded away from the public consciousness, but the celebrity culture of the NFL, obviously including Taylor Swift this year, and also just the draw of the game at large has literally never been bigger, which is kind of, I genuinely don't know how it happened.
Yeah. I mean, we've talked about other sports kind of struggling to maintain their viewership, Major League Baseball, the National Hockey League, a lot of college sports. And the NFL has seemed to be in some ways, like you said, we kind of thought that it was trending that way, given the data around CTE, the political kind of turmoil that the NFL got put into with Colin Kaepernick and the threats of boycott. And I mean, a couple other things as well. And yet here they are. I guess when this was the 58th Super Bowl, it has been over half a decade now where the NFL has been in many ways the dominant sports brand in this country. And the global reach is getting significantly larger every year as well. There are more and more games being played overseas every single year. And I think the NFL, I mean, it was not like it was regaining its number one spot. It's just proving that it is continuing to be the force to be reckoned with.
Don't you think it's odd that, you know, so much of our conversation about the changing nature of sports has been about like the TikTokification of sports and the fact that everything is being like spliced into little clips and kind of like hype moments. Don't you think it's odd that essentially the longest sport we have other than baseball in terms of hours in front of the TV to consume a game is the sport that is still doing the most? Like successful, at least in America. Obviously, soccer's global numbers are just not even close to comparable. But out of these sports, I mean, the NFL is increasing its reach, it feels like, with younger audiences, which to me is just, it kind of flies in the face of everything we've talked about like things being too long. I don't know.
No, it's true. I wonder if there's an extent to which the flow of football makes it more conducive as a social event, where like the breaks and the pauses are a good way to like to do it. It's a communal activity you can do with other people and kind of talk through it, as opposed to baseball, which requires more regular attention because there's something, you know, not every pitch is important, but there's going to be a pitch every few seconds or so. The NFL has as much as like a minute between plays. So it's plenty of time to go get a drink, go converse with a friend, run up and use the bathroom. And so I do wonder if the NFL is overcoming the time stuff because it becomes just like, I mean, people compare football to religion, but like it's like attending church, right? You go for the it might be a long service, but you're going for the communal aspect of it. It becomes just a regular part of your schedule and something you actually plan out for, as opposed to a baseball game, which you might try to fit in here and there, but don't normally change your schedule for.
Right. Which maybe the fact that there's one less games to figure it into your schedule, maybe that plays a factor. I do think it's also interesting that because it's such a, like an explosive sport, maybe it does lend itself to being clipped a little bit more, that you have specific plays that you can like pull out and just like put on Twitter or something. And even though it is long, it does have those moments you can keep coming back to, which all sports obviously do. But it feels like it can be distilled really easily into those plays.
That's
in a way
point.
That like a soccer game can with the goals, but in general, you know, I think soccer is the, in my opinion, the perfect in-stadium spectator sport because it's a flow, because you're on your feet the whole time. And I think football in many ways is built in this current edition for TV and also ultimately pretty well for social media, which is interesting.
John, we weren't even supposed to be talking about the NFL. That was just an aside. I do want to kind of give a bit of a roadmap, for where we're going today, because we're going to talk about a few different things. I think this is going to be a pretty interesting month here.
I think so.
On the Crunching Tackles podcast. We're considering doing a special podcast for Dune 2, which is a movie event that we're pretty excited about. That might happen next week. We're not committing to it, but we would like to do that. Then in terms of the sports, like, we're getting into March Madness, which is always a really, really big time on this podcast, something that we cover quite extensively. It's a huge part of the culture.
I don't know.
For
it
us.
Just, like, snuck up on me.
Yeah.
I don't know where it came from.
Same. And we're going to come back to college basketball on this podcast. That was part of the intro as well. And we're going to throw in a non-sports story, but a story that's kind of connected to a larger sports topic. So there's a little tease for that as well. But before any of that, John, we need to revisit our conversation about Everton Football Club, the other kind of football, and how they're doing in the Premier League and over there across the pond with the Brits.
That's exactly right. So last time we talked about this, I guess we've talked about this twice now.
Twice.
The first time when Everton was docked 10 points by the Premier League for breaching its profitability and sustainability rules, basically meaning Everton spent too much money, didn't make it back over the course of a 3-year period. They reappeared in our podcast feed when Everton, as well as Nottingham Forest, were docked again or were charged again. And I guess that was probably like a couple months ago now.
Yeah.
Which would mean that, you know, they'd been docked 10 points initially. If they got docked another 10 points, that's them losing 20 points in the standings, which is a huge deal.
And we had mentioned in the first podcast that Everton were going to be appealing the decision against them.
That's exactly right. So what came back on Monday of this week, February 26th, was the Premier League announcing that in the first case, Everton's appeal had been partially granted.
Yeah.
So Everton appealed on basically 9 counts of saying, you know, the Premier League did this unfairly. The Premier League rejected 7 of those, but accepted two counts of their appeal and decreased Everton's points suspension from 10 to 6. So Everton is now standing at 25 points, 5 points clear of the relegation zone right now, which when it comes to their safety come the end of the season could be a huge deal.
It's a big deal.
So, you know, if you want to hear some more, I don't think we need to go into all the details, but if you want to hear more details about what exactly the rules Everton breached were, you can go back and listen to those episodes. But I think what's interesting here is the two counts of their appeal that stood were, per The Guardian, one was that Everton initially was ruled to have acted in bad faith in basically accurately representing where the money for their stadium came from. The Premier League said that Everton intentionally essentially tried to hide the source of that money, and the appeal found that Everton actually just didn't accurately represent where it came from, but wasn't intentionally trying to do so.
Yeah, there wasn't malice behind their decision.
Mm-hmm. And the other was that the Premier League did not follow any previous benchmarks set by the English Football League, which is the league system below the Premier League, or even the penalties for other types of situations, that the points penalties specifically that the Premier League had applied to other teams, like the teams that tried to participate in the Super League a few years ago. And because of those two things, Everton's appeal did stand. However, this is still a loss for Everton, ultimately. Mm-hmm. I don't know where you think we stand after this, but the reality is all of the kind of financial reasons that Everton gave for why this was unfair were struck down in the appeal. And that means when the rules are applied to them again for the next 3-year period, the exact same penalty is going to be applied.
Right. It's really, really impossible to say where Everton are in terms of the 2023-2024 Premier League table, mm-hmm. because this appeal does not apply necessarily to the other sanctions that they've been charged with. They haven't actually been convicted of yet. So like you laid it out in the timeline, this reduction was in response to the initial charges that were found to be true. And these new charges that were laid against them alongside Nottingham Forest have not even been adjudicated yet or are in the process
That's exactly
of.
Right.
So it's entirely possible that there's another 10-point deduction coming, which likely could bury Everton.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know exactly if it would or not. Like, if nothing else happens, you'd expect Everton to be okay and to somehow escape relegation yet again. But there's so much still in limbo that I think we'll have to continue coming back to this.
Well, yeah, I do think that if they've set the precedent here that they're only going to do 6 points, if it's roughly comparable financial losses for this next period, I doubt that they'd go back up to 10.
They would just do 6 again.
I think they would do 6 again, which would put them right now on 19 points.
That'd be 19 points, yeah.
Which they'd be basically right around where Luton is. I think that if they got docked only 6, I think they would survive. That'd be my prediction. But obviously we don't know what's going to happen. But my gut tells me they're going to get docked again, which is crazy.
Do you think they'll stay up?
I think they'll get docked again, and I think they'll stay up.
Wow. Okay.
I think Sean Dyche. Yeah. I think he's got it. I think he's got the sauce.
No team has flirted harder with relegation than Everton have in the past 5 years.
And it's been remarkable.
Yeah,
they're still here.
They are. Is there anything else? I mean, I don't think there's a whole lot new we can add other than continuing to wait for these other things. Obviously, we've talked extensively about how Nottingham Forest and Manchester City are still in the mix mm-hmm. for similar sanctions. A Manchester City decision would just be massive in terms of where the top of the table is looking right now. But I do think that it makes sense to me that Everton would not have acted with malice, because like I said on the first podcast, regardless of whatever else was going on, both Everton and Nottingham Forest were putting in a good faith effort to be better teams.
Mm-hmm.
And because the results didn't match up with the money they spent, they're now being punished for actually trying to be competitive, which is the point that I've consistently made about why these rules kind of seem important, but dumb in the way that they're often executed.
That's 100% right. And I think really separates Everton and Nottingham Forest's case from Manchester City. Because both these teams, we know what their finances are and we know that they've lost money, right? We know that this is a problem for them. It's above board. They have just not been wise. And I understand the league punishing them for it based on their rules. The problem is that Manchester City is being accused of acting directly in the worst faith possible. And as of right now, have not been punished at all. And I think that's a serious problem that when you're looking at league justice, I understand that it takes longer to adjudicate. But I don't think the Premier League wants to punish Manchester City.
No, of course not.
And so that leaves us with them punishing the little guys for breaking the rules, like admittedly, but simultaneously not punishing the big guys who are intentionally breaking the rules and trying to hide it. And I think that's right. Kind of what this story comes down to for me.
Yeah, which would, of course, be outrageous. And, I mean, the conspiracy side of my brain would say that, you know, maybe if Liverpool were competitive, the Premier League might tip it to, like, you know, it's a cool story if Liverpool wins the league this year with their manager exiting. So, like, the conspiracy theory side of my brain says, you know, if it's close enough and Liverpool were in second place, maybe they do something to tip the edge. But I mean, again, it would be a much, 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 much more significant deal for Manchester City to face some sort of punishment here.
Mm-hmm. So much of me is always like, conspiracy theories, unreasonable. But you know what? I've seen enough soccer conspiracy theories to kind of believe most of them, to be honest.
Hmm. Interesting. We'll have to do a podcast on soccer conspiracy theories,
John. That's just a note. You know, that's just a note.
Anything else on this, John?
No, I think that's it. I think we've collectively talked about this topic for many minutes.
So. Yeah. I would like to bring a topic to the discussion table.
Would you?
Yeah, I would love to. This is an article that I found, and I read it, and then I sent it to you, and you also
you
read it.
You did great work, yeah.
And yeah, really just digging deep here. This story is about the actor Johnny Depp and his ties to Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia are, of course, a group of rich oil people that we have talked about frequently.
Certainly a description of a as nation well as, state.
As well as being a country. But we've really talked a lot about the way that they've tried to imprint their brand and their reputation in the sports by buying Newcastle, by buying soccer players, by moving into esports, by hosting Spanish finals in Saudi Arabia, and F1 and tennis, everything, golf, live, the whole gamut. We've really done the subject its due. And here's a story about Johnny Depp. Now, Johnny Depp, an actor that I like, I enjoy a lot of his movies. The Pirates of the Caribbean movies are good. Edward Scissorhands is good. People are very mixed on the Charlie and the Chocolate Factory movie. I don't mind it that much, but some people hate it. Whatever. Johnny Depp, I get him. Like, I understand him as an actor. He's obviously had this big controversy with his ex-wife, Amber Heard. Their public lawsuits against each other became quite a scandal. We're not all of that aside.
Leaving that way to one side.
Yeah. Johnny Depp still wants to make movies, John. And
he does.
One of the movies that he has been working on making is a French period piece called Jean du Barry, which I'm sure is something that you're just eagerly anticipating buying your ticket for, John.
You know it.
And this is a movie in which Johnny Depp is playing Louis XV. And this movie was in huge financial troubles. Like, it was teetering on the edge of falling through. The production was way over budget. Things were not going well. And John, when people need money, guess who can swoop in to save the day? The Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. And
whoa. Talk about a shocking, golden ticket, right? To be honest.
Yeah. And that's really good.
Please hold your applause. Thank you.
Anyway, so they come in and they contribute like $20 million to this movie. And in the process of doing that, as now major investors, they have now won the right to meet Johnny Depp. And so a prince meets Johnny Depp, and then eventually the crown prince, Mohammed bin Salman, meets him. And they strike up a friendship. And now they often travel together on Mohammed bin Salman's palace yacht, among like his fleet of palace yachts. And they visit each other, and they hang out, and they have deep, long, meaningful conversations up through all hours of the morning, because apparently Mohammed bin Salman is a night owl who, you know, works all night and sleeps all day. They play video games together because Mohammed bin Salman is a big gamer. And they, you know, talk about what really happened with Jamal Khashoggi and, you know, deal with the issues of life, John. They really, like, they have a deep bond. I imagine them sitting on a couch podcasting just like we're doing right now, except they don't release those podcasts to the world because that would obviously be quite controversial.
So what you're saying is that really what I'm getting from this story is that MBS is one of the boys.
It seems like it. Yeah, and, you know, so far there hasn't been, you know, a huge financial component to this. Obviously, they've been helping to fund his movies. But the mm-hmm. article from Variety Magazine goes further in depth about how Saudi Arabia is trying to imprint their way into Hollywood filmmaking, how they're now a destination for certain shoots, how they're trying to start funding their own projects. They have a film festival that Johnny Depp has attended that they've been trying to introduce Saudi Arabian filmmaking at. And on the back burner of this story is a reported 9-figure offer to Depp to be an ambassador for the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, whether that would look like a movie contract or just an ambassadorship, kind of like what Lionel Messi has, for example, mm-hmm. just to be part of the Saudi Arabia tourism brand. Regardless, though, I need to stop monologuing and turn this over to you and get your reaction to this, though. Johnny Depp is now in a relationship with these people, you know, similarly to these athletes we've talked about who have gone there to play, except it seems like he has an actual personal friendship with the guy who reportedly ordered the murder and dismemberment of Jamal Khashoggi. And, like, what are we to make of that?
A wonderful question, Chad. A wonderful question. And it takes me to really the most incredible moment in the Variety piece that I just want to lay out for the listeners, what occurred. Because apparently Johnny Depp, you know, in the interests of intimacy, like you would do when starting any friendship and you're worried about skeletons in the closet, Johnny Depp decided that it was time to ask MBS some tough questions. Some questions that, you know, that Tucker Carlson did not ask Vladimir Putin a couple weeks ago.
Some real hard-hitting journalism.
Some real hard-hitting journalism, you know? And who better to do it than Captain Jack Sparrow, you know?
That makes sense to me.
And the story has a really interesting sentence that just fascinated me about the bond between Johnny Depp and Mohammed bin Salman. And this story quotes, "Both men know how it felt to suddenly go from golden boy to outcast," end quote. Johnny Depp, of course, was outcast from Hollywood due to the Amber Heard situation in many ways. Mohammed bin Salman was outcast from society for dismembering a journalist. And, you know, I think those two things really kind of just like bond people together. I hope you guys hear the irony in my voice because I don't know what's going on.
A real trauma bond, John.
Really? And there's an incredible moment where it seems like Johnny Depp is like on Mohammed bin Salman's yacht or in his like camp or something, you know, out in the middle of nowhere among his billions of dollars. And much like, you know, the infamous scene at the end of The Godfather where Kay turns to Michael and says, "Michael, is any of it true what they're saying about you?" And Michael, of course, turns to her and says, "No." I like to think that that's exactly, of course, supposedly Khashoggi said, or Mohammed bin Salman said, you know, "I maybe had something to do with this, but of course, I would never directly order this."
What he said. What he said specifically, according to the story, is, "I did not directly order his murder and subsequent dismemberment, but I do take responsibility for it as leader of the country. And the inference there is that some, you know, overly eager subordinates decided to, that the spirit of what Mohammed bin Salman may have wanted was murder and dismemberment. But what he actually said for plausible deniability's sake is arrest him for espionage and bring him back to Saudi Arabia for trial.
Which really is some Godfather content when you think about it. I mean, I think this could be an incredible movie, and maybe, just maybe, that is a Johnny Depp story, you know, in the next decade. Mm-hmm. But in all seriousness, I think it's very strange to stop goofing around for a minute. I think it's just such a ridiculous story to a degree. I think it's ridiculous because what we've seen out of Saudi Arabia over the last many decades is a country completely closed off to entertainment, specifically the movie industry, because of obviously Islam being a huge part of the country's culture and the government. They were not interested in Hollywood, basically, from their view, corrupting their country. Lawrence of Arabia, I think that Variety article said, famously was not allowed to film in Saudi Arabia, which is a story essentially almost entirely set in Saudi Arabia, among other countries in the Middle East. And I think it's what's interesting here is that we're seeing MBS start to change that and basically preying upon kind of his easiest possible target, which is what the Saudis are doing in all of these different scenarios. And that's where our intersection comes in, because the Saudis, as we've talked about, have been preying upon basically weak sports, tennis, golf, esports. And now we are seeing them start to move into a new realm, which is film production. And they found one of the best possible stars who's out on their luck, but still has an unbelievable international appeal.
Yeah.
I think it's a winning play from them. I just think it's just strange. I mean, Johnny Depp's a weird guy, but like, it just seems like a strange match to me. I don't know.
You and I had an interesting off the mic conversation about this, and it prompted a lot of thought in my part about like, what does Mohammed bin Salman want in all of this? Because sports are easy to fund as entertainment, but movies are a cultural thing.
For sure.
And Hollywood is not culturally aligned with the traditional values of Islam.
Nope.
And the Middle East. Like this article mentions that they wanted to fund Megalopolis. Like, Francis Ford Coppola does not make Quran-approved movies. Neither does anyone in mainstream Hollywood, like, in terms of the role of women, in terms of the graphicness of the movies that mainstream Hollywood makes, things like that. Like, this is... If Mohammed bin Salman is trying to integrate his kingdom into the larger culture of the West, particularly Hollywood, mm-hmm. like, this is a major moral compromise on his part. And the article does seem to describe him as more of a cultural Muslim than a fundamentalist Muslim.
Sure.
You know, the elite, it's already been known that the elites in Saudi Arabia can drink alcohol, even though most people can't. They've started loosening restrictions on women driving or attending sporting events. We've talked about their continued persecution of LGBT people, but again, much, much, much less strictly so than Iran or Syria or Lebanon or other places. And so I guess this article and this move by MBS is really interesting to me, more so in a future direction of, mm-hmm. like, I guess... Here's how the best way for me to put it is, sports seemed like a really easy way for Saudi Arabia to impact the culture, the worldwide culture. But movies seem like a way that culture will have to start to impact the actual kingdom of Saudi Arabia in a different way.
You're right. And I think this is where I feel like we haven't talked about it this enough, to be honest. We have a little bit. But I think this is where the example of China comes into play, because this is a blueprint that has not This is not something that MBS is coming up with on its own. The Chinese, over the last 2-3 decades, have been following this for quite a while, both in the sports industry and in the movie industry. And we've seen with the movie industry that the Chinese, especially kind of in the, I guess, like the mid-2010s, early 2010s, really did a huge push to bring in a ton of American stars into kind of joint Chinese productions, thinking about like... what was that movie called with Matt Damon? Was it The Wall? The Great Wall, maybe?
Yeah, The Great Wall. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so movies like that where they were trying to basically, you know, either collaborate with Hollywood or bring in Hollywood resources or...
Yeah, Meg 2, The Trench.
Meg 2. Yeah, I mean, I feel like that was a little bit of a smaller impact.
The defining movie of 2023.
100%. But you know what I mean? So Meg 2, The Trench was actually mostly produced... Or at least like a huge amount of that was produced by Chinese studios. Mm-hmm. And no one in America knew about that, you know. But it was a movie produced in China, made mostly for Chinese audiences that also made it around here. And I think China got to the point where they were fine, basically, with building their movie industry up to the point where they didn't need Hollywood anymore. Because they don't actually want Hollywood's messages in China. That's not good for their That's not good for their control of the country.
They don't want
Saudi Arabia.
Map.
Right. Saudi Arabia is at the start of that, though. And so they have a lot of work to do if he wants to be a cultural power similar to China. He's going to have to look outside his borders in a way that China doesn't have to. And so I think he is taking lessons from the beginning of China's kind of path here. But he will need to think about, I think we'll see probably... an attempt to bring in a lot more Hollywood resources from his side of things than China ultimately did.
Yeah, I mean, and it could start with just opening it up for other studios to film scenes mm-hmm. in Saudi Arabia, yeah. and then it translates to importing mainstream Hollywood stars or directors into the Saudi Arabian system. For example, mm-hmm. like I mentioned, they have a film festival. They invited people like Martin Scorsese to that festival. He declined. But like, would someone start to say yes? Actually, yes, Baz Luhrmann has attended the Saudi Arabian film festival. So they start to import people that are recognized. And then eventually they could try to make their own Hollywood alternative, like the Chinese have done, like Bollywood in India, mm-hmm. and try to you know, make original Saudi Arabian produced movies. That kind of the three avenues they could go.
But think about it. Like, you get a young up and coming director who has a lot of great ideas, but doesn't have a lot of money. Just like with Live Golf.
Tempting.
Saudis say, hey, will you make this movie? Make a few changes. You get an extra salary on top of us funding this movie. Mm-hmm. I think that's with how tight the movie industry is right now, I don't think the effects of that can be understated if they choose to invest the same amount of money that they're investing in sports in the movie industry, which is not great because messaging is more direct in movies. And that makes me
100%
uncomfortable, but yeah. It will happen.
It will. Yeah. John, our big story this week is what I'm calling the Chad's a grumpy old man corner of the podcast.
Really a shout out to Var Corner of the past.
Yeah, we need to talk about fan behavior and court storming or field storming because mm-hmm. Saturday, Wake Forest, unranked ACC team at home against Duke. At that time, the number 8 team in the country, I believe, was Duke. And Wake Forest beat them by 4 points immediately, like as soon as the whistle blows and the buzzer sounds, the fans are just rushing the field. And... in the process, a fan collides with Duke star Kyle Filipowski as he's trying his best to get off the court. He hits him right in the knee. Kyle Filipowski immediately comes up limping. Fears are that he's, you know, done a really bad injury. Could it be the ACL? Could it be a sprain? It turns out that Kyle Filipowski is going to be okay. Like, it doesn't seem like it's any sort of major injury concern. Mm-hmm. But regardless, this debate is now... the match is lit. This debate is going off. ESPN are talking about it. Former players are weighing in. And I frankly wanted to weigh in. And I know you kind of want to make this a broader conversation as well. But that's kind of why I'm bringing this to the table.
Yeah, I think, you know, this is something that happens in a wide variety of sports. Not usually. I mean, it's happened in football. It's happened at Liberty. I mean, I've seen multiple pitch invasions, field invasions, storming the court, field, whatever you want to call it. It's something that's happened in soccer since it started, basically. It happens in college sports here, I feel like, a lot more than it does in professional sports, namely because it's banned in the NBA, I believe. So that kind of would put a damper on that. And I don't know that that's a super common thing that happens in the NFL in particular.
Have you done it? Have you done either?
So I think I went on the court briefly when Liberty won the ASUN conference in 2020. So right before the news of the pandemic hit. I think that was the only time. But Liberty basically did it every time we won a conference title or had a big football win. It feels like I'm trying to wrap my head around it, because I know, like, in soccer it happens sometimes, especially with lower league teams, if they get promoted or something like that, or win like a huge upset, like FA Cup tie, where you have like a fourth division team beat a Premier League team, that'll happen. But it feels much less common, especially because of after the Hillsborough disaster in the 80s, fan restrictions just got tighter in the Premier League, just to avoid crowd crushes with that many people being there. It seems like, I don't know what your experience is, if you ever did it, but it seems like college sports, it's like a much more regular thing than I understood.
Yeah, I did it twice. I did the same basketball game that you did. And then also in 2018, there was a football game. I don't remember who the other team was, but because Liberty won the game on a blocked field goal as time expired, the fans went on the field.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, it's an unsanctioned activity either way, so it's not like there are written rules of when and how to do it. The unwritten rules seem to be you were either a significantly worse team, who it's a major upset situation, so you do it.
Right.
App State storming it when they beat Michigan, when Michigan was ranked number 2 back like a decade ago, is one example. Option B, you beat your number 1 rival in a really, really dramatic way. The Iron Bowl kick 6 where Alabama kick the field goal short, Auburn return it for a touchdown and win the game. They go on the field. That's the other one. Those are kind of like, and then I guess like I have felt like it started to become more lax and people do it more frequently and like for less reasons. But those are kind of like traditionally the two major reasons why fans would do it. To me, like the reasons don't make a whole lot of sense. I was tweeting about this earlier this week, but like it's pretty much like you storm the court when you acknowledge that you were the worst team and are surprised that you won. Like it ultimately is a reaction of surprise.
Mm-hmm.
Like joy is not really necessarily that way. Like when you win a game, you're happy. But like when the emotion that caused people to want to go be on the court or on the field is like, oh my goodness, I can't believe we did this. And if you take that to its like logical extent, what you're saying is, man, I thought we were worse and I thought we were going to lose. I didn't really believe in our team. And now that we've done this, I'm so happy and so surprised that I'm going to go run onto the court. And I think we could talk about like specific instances where it might be okay and where it could be done in a more orderly and appropriate fashion. But we have to acknowledge that this is an entirely unruly and inappropriate behavior in any way it's going to happen. And as soon as they start actually trying to regulate it, it stops being an authentic expression of, I guess, joy, which is what it in theory is.
Right.
Although I don't really understand that.
I think a great example recently of a time when it just like seemed like a very natural thing, at least in my mind, was when UT beat Bama last year. It was very much an acknowledgement that UT has been the inferior team for like the last decade. I don't feel like that's controversial. But it was also like a hype moment, you know? So I feel like sometimes fans maybe don't mind the fact that it is a surprise. I think that's part of what makes it, in defense of it for a second, I think that's part of what makes it the tradition special. So ESPN did a review in college basketball, and like this season, It said that three storms a week on average have happened in college basketball this season, I think on both the men's and women's side, which just seems like a lot. I mean, I guess a lot of basketball games happen every week, but it just feels like, to me, if we're just talking about the tradition as a whole, if it's that exciting of a thing, it shouldn't be happening all the time.
Yeah. Even the Tennessee one, like, I don't accept it because
I know,
Tennessee,
but you're a Bama fan. You're mad.
No, but also, like, no, that's not why. It's because Tennessee was ranked number six in the country.
Right.
Like, Tennessee, like, what is, they're not the number one rival, and they weren't, like, they were marginally, they were, I think, one lower than Alabama in the ranking, but, like, it's not a real dramatic upset.
Well, yeah, we have two different things here. One is, like, when is it okay to storm the field? And also, on a safety reason, should you be allowed to? Those are two different arguments. Like, Man City...
Well, my answer is the same to both.
Right, no, I know. You just don't like it either way. I'm just saying those are two separate... Like, if you're arguing about it, they're two separate things.
Sure.
Man City fans stormed the pitch in, I think it was 2022, when they came back from 2-0 down to beat Aston Villa and win the Premier League. And Aston Villa goalkeeper Robin Olsen was injured. Not like severely, but he was injured. He was like hit by a fan or a fan threw something at him. Manchester City has obviously won basically every title that there is to win in the sport. It's like Patriots fans rushing the field after winning number six Super Bowl with Tom Brady. Like, it's just deeply silly. And so I agree with you there that, like, there is no reason for fans who win everything all the time to be doing that all the time.
Yeah. The point I really wanted to get to, though, is thinking about this from a safety standpoint.
Yeah,
the fan safety is a subsequent. I don't really care about fan safety. I mean, I do, but not in this conversation. I really want to talk about player safety.
Well, that's what the coaches are mad about.
It is, and it makes perfect sense. And I want to let's talk about this Duke Wake Forest game.
Yep.
Duke is shooting free throws with like 3 seconds left. Or maybe someone's who, like, it's like, you know, like, you are entirely focused on trying to win this close game. It's a 4-point game.
Yep.
Duke, I think Duke is actually like down two and they're shooting free throws. They miss and then Wake Forest runs down the court and like scores and time expires or whatever. But Kyle Filipowski, no part of his brain should be thinking at that point, oh my goodness, how am I going to get off this court when there's still 3 seconds 100%. Left? To be an elite athlete, you have to be entirely focused on the task at hand, which is doing your best to win this game. And then immediately when that buzzer sounds, your entire brain is now supposed to flip from how can I win this game to how can I safely exit this court without my fight or flight response activating by this mob of 18 to 22 year old people who all hate me running at me all at the same time. It's completely outrageous that we ask college athletes to do that. I'm actually describing it stunned that there aren't more like physical altercations between players just because their fight or flight response activates in that moment.
Sure.
You don't have no chance to like grieve the loss. You have no chance to process anything that's going on. You go from 100% game mode to, oh my goodness, a mob are storming at me like the horse is attacking Jon Snow in that meme where he, you know, picks up the sword and the horses are charging at him. Like, it's insane. It literally makes no sense how they could allow college athletes to go through that experience in any sport.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it reminds me... I mean, there was an incident where I forget who Crystal Palace was playing now, but I think they lost a game, maybe in the FA Cup. The opposing team's fans stormed the field and a fan attacked, basically like jumped on the coach.
Yeah, Crystal Palace manager.
And he just, Patrick Vieira was a scary player back in the day and he kicked the fan and got him off of him. And everyone was like, wow, okay, well go Patrick Vieira. You know, but like, it shouldn't be getting to that point. I think you're absolutely right. Like, there should be no scenario where you have an uncontrolled surge of people who are not, I mean, stewards and police and security are in stadiums around the world to avoid crowd trouble because crowd trouble, you know, unfettered in the late 1800s, early 1900s, and in plenty of stadiums around the world to this day, kills people. Right? Like, that's the reality. Unruly crowds are a danger. That's why crowd control exists in any crowd circumstance, in riots and protests, all that kind of stuff. So I think in this situation, I think it's an interesting point that you say about the mind switch, because there was an ESPN analyst who was on TV, I believe, and basically said Kyle Filipowski is somewhat at fault for basically not hustling off the court, which is just like
outrageous.
A crazy take. It's an outrageous take. Like he shouldn't be, you're right, he shouldn't be responsible. Security should be responsible for making sure that the situation doesn't get out of hand. And if they need to usher him off the court, then they should do that. And the stadium should be ready for that. If you're not going to ban it entirely and you're not going to find teams, then you need to have processes set in place to protect your players. Yeah. If you're not going to, you know, if you don't want to do that, then you do need to take steps to, you know, stop this from happening. I think you're right. There's no two ways about it. So like Clemson fans storm the field literally every game. And so I guess my question to you, as someone who's like much more tuned into college sports, like culture than me, do schools like that lose something if we get rid of this entirely? Or is it just not worth the risk, even if we do lose a little bit?
To me, it's not worth the risk. Like I'm not a big traditions and culture guy. I'm very much a game guy. I wasn't a huge part of the culture of a college when I went to one. To me, the number one thing has to be player safety 100% of the time. Now, I would caveat that by saying the behavior that we're trying to eliminate is the uncontrolled mob storming a field or a court immediately after a game while opposing while players are still trying to exit.
Sure.
So if there was a 2-minute delay and then fans orderly came down to be on a field, okay. If like with the ASUN with us in the ASUN championship or any time a team is winning the championship, I think this would be fine in the pros too. If you erect the stage where they're gonna win, where they're gonna receive the trophy, and then they say, okay, we're gonna open gates 5 and 6 and people can come down and be on the field. There's going to be a barrier where the stage is. Don't cross the barrier, but you can come down and participate in this trophy ceremony. Fine by me. If Clemson wants to say 3 minutes after the game, when all of what after the coaches do the handshake, after all the players get to greet or whatever, and the opposing players are gone, you guys want to come down, sing a song. Fine. If fans decide that they want to go parade down the middle of the street after a game, like that's the police's problem. I'm not the traffic control. That's not an issue for me. I don't care about any of that. You know, Chapel Hill has a street that App State has a street too, that like I've seen where like they win a game and everyone just starts running down the street on the road. Again, not a player issue. The police can handle that if they want to or not. But I'm really, really not serious. I'm not joking about how serious I think this. I think that the type of incident that happened in Duke at Wake Forest, the college should institute a rule that says the next home game has no student section.
Yeah,
like they should ban students from participating in the next game. Like it has to be enough to send a message that this behavior is completely unacceptable, and it is. And it's not. I'm literally 25 years old. I know the college experience. I'm not trying to ruin kids' experience. I'm not an old man complaining about this. It's just like
you are. That's okay. Yeah.
Whatever. you see that video?
Yeah.
And it's just completely unacceptable. And a fine won't matter because the kids won't play the fine. The school will. Other things won't. Like, it has to be you are deprived from attending a future game if you do this.
Right. Yeah, I think that's interesting. I think, obviously, advocates of this will say that, you know, if you set regulations on it, then it's not natural. But I think you're right that, like,
it shouldn't be a natural behavior to storm someone's workplace.
Yeah. Put it that way, absolutely. And I think it's a natural.
This is not January 6th.
I think that's a good way of putting it. That like a disorderly assault on the field is a relic of a bygone era where we allowed people to do whatever they want in a sporting arena. to be honest.
Yeah.
You know, there was something unique about that time when you could, you know, go to a Premier League game in England and get beat right. up in the street.
Right.
But there's like a certain lure about that.
Yeah.
But it doesn't mean that we want it.
Publicly acknowledged filters on behavior is a good thing.
Like, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I think you're right. And I think the fact that this keeps happening tells us that it needs to stop. You know, I agree that I think there's something unique about a fan base taking ownership of a field, like actually being on it, because you never get to do that. In special moments.
That's fine. That's fine.
And I think your kind of compromise does make sense, that, but it needs to be like set out. And I think there does need either there needs to be a time limit, or it just needs to be the last player has left the court and you say you are now allowed to come down. And I think there do need to be, I think you're right, that will keep happening unless there are consequences for those barriers being broken. But yeah, I think it does need to stop. Thinking yeah. The more I think about it, I think the more that there's most of the positives you get from that experience, you can have in an orderly way, and yeah. all of the negatives are removed if you control the situation.
I would say this in my sports, and I would also say it in my politics when it comes to Washington, D.C. in January. But if yeah. you find yourself in a place where a physical barrier or physical security don't want you to be, yep. that's your fault.
Yep.
And agreed. You should not be in that place, wherever it may be.
Wherever it may be.
Be it the field, be it the center court at Wake Forest University, or in the rotunda of our nation's capital. That's where I plant my flag on, be where you're supposed to be and not where you're not supposed to be. And I here I stand.
So what you're saying is you would not appreciate it if one day you saw a video of me in a Buffalo helmet on the basketball court of the University of Wake Forest.
Just shirtless with a skin vest and a Buffalo helmet. I would have questions, John. I would have some real questions.
Oh my gosh. Oh, yeah. Man. I mean, I think it's a reasonable solution. And I think there's really not that much, like, there's really not much to argue about at this point.
Yeah.
The reality is this is an extensive issue that keeps happening. And I think as long as as we can maintain in an orderly fashion, I think some of the fun in those moments, you know, that doesn't just completely strip, I don't know, the spirit, especially in a small school, you know, like the moment of beating a big school on your home turf and having that moment on your court is something that is really unique, and it does happen. And I don't think that should be taken away from those fan bases, because it is, you know, the most exciting thing that can happen to yeah. you if you're yeah. a lower grade D1 or D2 school.
All I'm asking for is extemporaneous joy on a 3-minute delay.
Yep.
Just postpone your joy for 3 brief minutes, count to 180, and then go for it.
Yeah, I mean, you postpone your joy throughout the whole game.
Literally.
So just have a little bit extra patience.
Yeah, have some decorum.
Have some decorum.
Yeah.
Joy yeah. with decorum. I believe joy with decorum. Is really the motto of this podcast, to be honest.
When the crunching tackles presidential party... When you and I run for president, joy with decorum would be a great motto for us. I hate to break it to you,
we will not win any elections.
We would get approximately 5 votes.
I think so.
And that's kind of exactly where I want to be. So.
Yeah, I agree. I think if we got any more votes, I'd start to worry about our character. So.
In this country, I certainly would. John, briefly on our way out of here, and I do need to bring this back into a proper place here.
Yeah.
We've talked a lot about sports documentaries and Netflix documentaries and things of that nature. And the great sin of this podcast is that neither of us had actually seen the most important one of these, the one that's that true. Started it all, which is Netflix's mm-hmm. Formula One Drive to Survive show. Well, I can tell you that I've corrected that error. I have watched 3.5 seasons.
It's a lot of seasons
of this show. And I think it's absolutely incredible. It in terms of what Formula One wanted out of it, they've got it, which is a new fan. I could not possibly be more locked into the Formula One season that starts on March 2nd at 10 a.m. Eastern time. Like I'm here.
He's a fan. He's here.
I'm ready.
I mean, we talked about this literally 4 years ago, which is hilarious that neither of us have ever even tried it up until this point. But we talked about it because it started a phenomenon in America of people getting into Formula One, which had just literally never happened before.
I completely understand it. I think this
you
is
get
some
it.
Of
the, yeah,
it is compelling stuff. It's better than any of the other alternative documentaries in other sports by a comfortable margin.
And we have at least a few listeners who have regularly contacted me about talking about more Formula One. To you, listeners, you know, here we go.
Yeah, I was spurred on by, you know, the final kick was the Lewis Hamilton announcement that he's moving to Ferrari in 2025. And obviously, like, I've loosely followed Formula One, and that, like, just set off alarm bells in my mind. Like, oh my God, it's like, this is a big deal. And so it's time for me to lock in. And so I did. The great thing about the Drive to Survive show is that cars going fast on camera always works. Like, there is no bad version of that sentence. Like any iteration of things go fast on camera is going to be good viewing.
That's true.
And Formula One has some awesome personalities. Like it's so fun. Like at the top of the table, there's this huge Mercedes Red Bull rivalry. At the bottom, there are these teams that are in like real struggles to exist or like battling for third. It's just awesome personalities. Gunther Steiner, who was the principal up until this year of Haas, is just an incredible personality. Some of the drivers are awesome. No driver skips out on it. Like Lewis Hamilton is not too big for the show. He's in it. Everyone's in it. It is just awesome. And there's so much drama in Formula One inside the teams because, you know, the two teammates are actually rivals and want to beat each other. And you get into these situations where the team's goals don't align with the driver's goals. And so sometimes the teams will tell a driver, you can't pass your teammate during this race. And it, you know, causes this big issue. But that's just part of the politics. The
reminds me of Ford versus Ferrari.
Yeah. The inter-team fighting is just elite. Drivers are constantly being stolen from each other and like going out of contract. There's interchanges. I've watched, I think, 3 seasons, and Daniel Ricciardo, the driver, has already raced for 3 different teams in these 3 seasons. It is just, yeah, I could not say more about the show. I need you to start watching it. I need you to become a Formula One fan too, so that we can do more Formula One on this podcast, because it does intersect with a lot of other things we talked about, like the Russian oligarch story affected Formula One in a really interesting way that I wasn't prepared for until I got to it in the show. It's been kind of weird, like, learning these things that happened in 2019 and 2020. Like, I'm currently in the middle of the 2021 season, so all these things I'm still very much behind on. But I'm now a committed fan to this product.
I do want to say that I feel like the brand of this podcast is an F1 brand. I think that's fair to say. So yeah. I think it would only be right that eventually I make my way over to that. We both know that I'm very slow when it comes to TV, so I cannot promise when I will finish Drive to Survive.
It's fine.
But I will start it. And I think that's the thing I can commit to. And you know, who doesn't love cars going fast? My primary complaint with Michael Mann's Ferrari released last year was that there was not enough cars and they were not going fast enough.
No, they were
for
not.
The majority of the film. And you know, if I can rectify that, ideally with Adam Driver driving in Drive to Survive, that would be great. But in lieu of that,
yeah,
you know, maybe I can try the show. So that's
I can promise you approximately 0 Adam Driver, unfortunately.
That's really unfortunate.
It's interesting, and I'm not gonna like I can't spoil previous, you know, things of Formula One, but season 4 has definitely been the best season so far, and it's because like this is when the rivalry, there had always been a Red Bull Mercedes quote unquote rivalry, but it was just super one sided, For 7 years, Mercedes won 7 Constructors' Championships in a row, including the first 3 seasons of Formula One Drive to Survive, which is the 2018, 2019, 2020 seasons. And this fourth season, which is the 2021 season, is the first season where the actual table is neck and neck the entire way. And there was a very, very dramatic final day to the 2021 tournament that has still sent repercussions to the sport to this day. It's an I watched that actually live. And so, this is where it's really, really gotten quite good before now. I guess Red Bull are on a bit of the rivalry is kind of tilted the other way in a big way, where Red Bull have kind of ran Mercedes out the building the past couple seasons. Spoiler alert for actual events of Formula One.
Max Verstappen.
But he's a good driver.
He's a good driver.
And Lewis Hamilton hates him.
I'm sure he does, because Lewis Hamilton sucks right now. Even I know that.
That's true. And Max is it's interesting when you get the two best players have such different philosophies toward racing. Mm-hmm. Where Lewis is a very confident but muted driver, and there is not a single chance that Max Verstappen won't take and a single line that he will not push to get what he wants. It's great. It's really, really special stuff.
I'm very excited. And you know what else I'm excited for that will push every line and will take every risk? Do you know what that is, Chad?
Is it a movie?
It's a movie that is coming out in 2 days from when we are talking right now on Tuesday, February 27th. Dune Part 2, as you mentioned at the top of the show, will be releasing wide in 2 days.
Yeah. 48 hours from right now, I will be walking out of the theater, and hopefully my mind will be just completely changed.
If you follow this podcast at all, if you've listened to the show at this point, you are not surprised that we are about to be locked in to Dune Part 2.
Yeah.
Like Chad said,
yeah,
we're not committing yet to a full pod. We will talk about Dune 2 on this podcast.
Just check your feeds next week.
There might be a
little gift.
There might be a little gift. It won't be too long. Don't worry.
No.
We won't talk about sand for that long. Really, because what you need to be doing instead of listening to us is just going to watch Dune again.
And again. And again.
I already have 2 tickets for this weekend at 2 separate showings. So I just want to know that. Yep. I'm excited.
The hype,
it's going to be the movie
event.
The hype
for this movie is unreasonable.
It's unreasonable. I can't wait. And I can't wait to hear what you think. And I can't wait to share it with the listeners. That, even more than March Madness, is what my March is going to be all about. I am in full-blown Dune season.
I will have no fear. Fear is the mind killer. The next time that we podcast, words on Dune will be spoken, whether it is as an entire mini pod or as a closing segment to a future sports related pod. But I'm sure that the people are going to flock to Dune. The first movie was such a big success. It is I can't go 5 minutes on my television without seeing an ad for it. They're really pushing this thing. And it's because I think that they know they got one. They got something special.
My last thought for the day. I saw this, saw someone say this on Twitter earlier, and the more I've thought about it, the more I agree with it. I am so glad this movie got delayed, which I never thought I would say, because I really thought that the hype leading up to it in November was off the charts. But the hype that we're seeing right now for this is on another level, to the point where Kung Fu Panda 4 has made a Dune-themed trailer for itself.
Yeah, yeah. And to the point where I think Oppenheimer and Dune 2 in the same year would have kind of diminished how good both of these movies. Because now they both have the opportunity to kind of dominate the critics' awards in different years. And I think that's good, because both of these movies, it seems like, I've seen one of them and I know one of them does, but hopefully both deserve to have really, really awesome box offices and really, really awesome award seasons. And it would be really sad if Dune and Oppenheimer had kind of cut each other's Oscars in half, for example, or whatever. So
100%. Yeah. I'm very glad for that. And I can't wait.
Can't wait. Until then, John. Until then. We hope that you all continue to be well and be safe, and we will talk to you later.
All right. Cheers, guys.